Hello, and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, April 14th, 2023. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This year's federal budget, the Liberal government announced a $13 billion plan to expand dental care to families earning less than $90,000 a year, fulfilling the government's commitment to the New Democrats. This, of course, is a major step forward for dental care in Canada. But is it enough? Or do we also need to rethink the structure of dental care in Canada as a whole? This week on Rabble Radio, national politics reporter Stephen Wenzel speaks to Dr. Brandon Doucette about his new book, About Canada Dental Care. Brandon Doucette is a Nova Scotia-based dentist, founder of the group Coalition for Dental Care, and author of About Canada Dental Care. Here are Wenzel and Doucette in conversation. Take a listen.
All right, so Brandon, it's good to sit down and chat with you. It's been a few years, actually, back in the day in the fight for 15, when it was the fight for 15. Brandon, you were the one who kind of helped train me and get me ready to do canvassing and organizing and stuff like that. So it's really great we could come full circle and chat about your new book.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So your new book, Dental Care in Canada, you come to this with some firsthand experience. You're a dentist yourself. And so I'm kind of wondering to jump in, where did the idea for the book come from? And what was your goal with writing it?
So the idea for the book really came from the advocacy work that I've been doing with relationship to access to dental care for many years. This started in my last year of dental school from just seeing people not being able to access dental care, reading more about the research to find out that it's not just the odd person falling through the cracks, but large segments of the population who are unable to access dental care, which is one of the reasons you see people come in at such a late stage of dental disease. Because at first, it didn't really make sense as a dental student. I'm like, why are people coming in needing all of their teeth extracted? Like, they would have been in so much pain for so long. Like, how did it get to this point? Like, it just wasn't really making sense to me. And the more I read and learned about it, I just realized it's because they couldn't afford to come in sooner. That was the biggest factor that led to these problems. And I started to do some advocacy work, like writing newspaper articles, talking on radio shows and stuff like that. But I realized that as an individual, I wasn't really able to, you know, have that cohesive of a push for a universal dental plan, which is why I formed the group Coalition for Dental Care, which is a group that, you know, has various dental professionals, members of the public, and people from all walks of life, basically trying to highlight the shortcomings of Canada's dental care system while also advocating for a more humane alternative. With the work that I've done for this organization, it really led me to like wanting to write a book, because you realize how short 1,000 words is when you're writing an article. And with some extra time off during some of the COVID lockdowns, I tried to make use of that time by taking some of my articles, in particular the one about the school-based dental program in Saskatchewan, and kind of expanding that into a chapter and kind of realizing how part of this could fit into a broader narrative to tell the story of what's the history behind Canada's current dental care system, how did we get where we are, and where do we need to go? And that's really, I just see the book as an extension of that work.
Now, this might be a tough question, but I'm wondering, you talked a bit about people having to put off dental care until they're in very serious situations. How much public taxpayer dollars are being, I guess, wasted by people being forced to wait until it's an emergency to seek dental care?
So it can be hard to like very quantifiable, give like overall estimates. So it's easier to kind of narrow on very specific things that are tangible. Like when people can't afford to go to the dentist, many people end up in emergency departments and doctor's offices to seek relief from dental pain. This actually accounts for about 1% of emergency room visits and costs over $150 million per year. And when all is said and done with this, those people are still left needing to see a dentist afterwards because physicians are not trained to treat the root cause. They're not treated to to, you know, they don't know how to do root canals or take out teeth and stuff like that. So the person is given an antibiotic or pain medication and told to go see a dentist afterwards. So it's really a waste of money. We can also look at the effects of poor oral health have on our overall health. So poor oral health can cause diabetes complications. It can worsen heart disease. It can increase rates of aspiration pneumonia as people inhale the bacteria buildup on their teeth. Also, dental infections can be localized, but if it overwhelms your body, it can lead to sepsis and, you know, spread to other parts of your body, which can lead to life-threatening infections, which is very dangerous. There's a story in the CBC about a year ago that I think did a really good job at highlighting how inefficient Canada's healthcare system is in dealing with these problems. There was a gentleman named Shane McKenzie who was in his 30s that had a dental infection that led to sepsis because his body got overwhelmed by this infection. This led him to ending up being in the intensive care unit for about 10 days. He was in and out of the hospital for, I think it was over a year with like the long-term care settings. And he, in this process, he ended up needing dialysis for his kidneys. He lost one of his legs below his knee because the infection spread and overwhelmed his body. He lost all the toes and fingers on one of his feet and one of his hands, and he lost a few fingers on the other hand. So incredible to think how much suffering that was caused by lack of access to dental care for this individual. It is also incredible to think how much resources went into treating this person's medical condition, being very reactive to a problem that would have been way cheaper to treat by just simply investing upstream in a public dental program and preventing this problem from happening in the first place, because we have the technology to solve these problems. We have, you know, the resources. It's just we don't have the distribution because the funding of dental care in Canada is so privatized. I believe it's about 94% of dental spending in Canada comes from private sources, so out-of-pocket payments, private insurance, and stuff like that, which leaves a very, very small amount coming from government programs. And that small amount leads to very large inequalities in access to dental care. If we look at the share of public funding of dental care as a share of overall dental spending, we do even worse than the Americans, who their public dental spending is at about 10%, and do way worse than countries, say, like Germany and Japan, whose respective percentages of public dental spending, I believe, is like 56% and 78% or something like that. So we're a very big outlier internationally in this issue.
That feeds perfectly into my next question. So I'm wondering, we have so little public funding for dental care. How can we get more public dental care instead of relying on private practice in the future?
For sure. So at first, we need to kind of look at like the funding of dental care and then the delivery of dental care, because there is potentially some movement at the federal level on increasing public funding of dental care, with the federal NDP's dental plan kind of being at the center of the supply and confidence agreements between the NDP and the Liberal Party. Basically, in this federal minority parliament, the NDP said, if you want to gain our support to the Liberals, you need to implement our dental plan. The Liberals basically looked at that and said, sure, we'll drag this out over 4 years, you know, do it in a stepwise fashion so that you can't, you know, we won't give you what you want right away, and then you'll just back out of the deal or something like that. And so far, there's some promising signs for this, because basically the Liberals haven't been polling very well. So it means if they try to, you know, back out of their promises and trigger an election, they're probably not going to do very well in it. So far, they've had to follow through with their promises. The recent federal budget announced, I believe it was $13 billion over 5 years for the NDP dental plan, which will be implemented in a stepwise fashion, with about $4 billion as an ongoing, you know, once the program is fully up and running, that's how much will be set aside each year, which is a massive step in the right direction. Still a lot of work needs to be done, but to give perspective of this, we currently spend about $1 billion a year on public dental programs. So adding $4 billion on top of that is definitely a big step in the right direction. But if we put this in context of, you know, where this would leave us, even if it does, you know, I don't want to count our chickens before they hatch here, but let's say this program does come to fruition, that would bring us to about 25-30% of dental spending being publicly funded. So it's definitely better than 5 or 6%, but it still leaves us a little bit below the OECD average, you know, if we're comparing ourselves to other developed countries. So definitely movement in the right direction, but there's a lot of work that's left to be done. One of my concerns, if we just implement the NDP dental plan and we don't see this as a stepping stone to something greater, is the politics of these targeted programs. Because what ends up happening is there ends up being resentment between the people who aren't eligible for these programs, but are paying into them through their taxes. And then also the people who do benefit from these programs, there's kind of a tension, which makes them more easy to undermine politically, which ends up making these programs worse over time, whether that be fewer people covered by the programs, fewer services covered, or what we see as well is the fees the programs pay out end up getting de-indexed from inflation, which makes it so that there's a gap between what public dental programs pay and what private dental programs pay, which ends up leading to discrimination against people relying on the public programs, because a dentist looks at it as, I can make more money treating someone who has a private plan than someone who has a public plan. These are all problems that we've seen with the existing public dental programs in Canada, because at one point in time, I mean, they weren't perfect, but they were definitely better than they were now. And around 1980, public dental spending accounted for about 20% of overall dental spending. And over time, we've seen that eroded away to its current 6%. So what I see as needed is we need to use this momentum around public dental care right now and really harness this and see, like, look how successful, look how beneficial this is. This program should cover everyone. Because if we can get to that point where everyone is covered by a single program, I don't think there's any going back from that. Conservatives obviously try to undermine our universal healthcare system in many ways, but none of them could come out and just say, I'm running on privatizing healthcare. They would lose the election in a heartbeat. And I think the same thing would happen with dental care, because when everyone relies on the program, cutbacks tend to be seen as an attack on the society as a whole, which face much broader backlash, and it's much more politically stable because of that. And that's us kind of looking at the funding of dental care. I also think that we need to look at the delivery of dental care as well, because having the dentist-centered model in private practices under the fee-for-service model leads to many inequalities in access to care as well, because patients are competing for chair time with people who want, you know, Hollywood smile makeovers. They want implants. They want, you know, people who have thousands and thousands of dollars to just throw at these things. You know, a child who needs to go to the operating room is going to have to compete for that time. Whereas I think fundamentally we need to shift more towards providing care based on need rather than how profitable someone will be in your chair for a chunk of time. So that's why I suggest that we look more towards a public delivery model of dental care, which was very successful in Saskatchewan in the 1970s and 80s, where they had what are known as dental therapists doing the majority of the dental work. And these are dental providers that can do procedures like fillings, simple extractions, cleanings, all at the fraction of the cost of a dentist. They're very effective at increasing the dental workforce to meet the population needs, to make sure that the most marginalized communities, the people in long-term care settings, the people with a disability, whatever it might be, they don't only access care when they're in pain and dealing with emergency. They're very important to make sure that these populations access comprehensive care. Because it tends to be those people, even with public funding of dental care, those most marginalized groups tend to be the people who have the hardest time getting to a private practice dental clinic. You could imagine how difficult it is to get out of a long-term care setting, get to the nearest private practice dental clinic. Is that place even wheelchair accessible? Do they have some sort of setup? So, like, there's actually setups that can put a wheelchair on a little stand and tilt it back so that for people who can't get out of a wheelchair, but most private practices don't see enough patients to justify something like that. Whereas these public delivery models can take these things into account and try to actually make sure that these people who tend to be the people who need help the most actually access comprehensive care. And they're not just getting in when they're dealing with pain and infection, which tends to be what happens. The dental therapists as well, they're also a very cost-effective way. So they're much cheaper. If you look at, you know, why does a filling have to cost $250? Well, it's because dentists have a monopoly on care, and they're the ones that's been dictating the terms of these things for many decades, which is why the cost of dental care has been rising faster than inflation for many decades. So having dental therapists helps break dentists' monopoly on care because dentists aren't the only game in town. You could have someone come in and say, I'm willing to do a filling for half of that cost, which is what we ended up seeing with the Saskatchewan Dental Plan. The school-based dental clinics that I was mentioning, they weren't working on a fee-for-service basis. So it wasn't like they were paid per specific filling, but if you looked at the overall cost of the program per child, it was way more cost-effective to have these dental therapists work in these school-based dental clinics to the point where dentists became threatened by this because they felt like they were encroaching on their territory, on their monopoly on care, and they felt like, if people see how successful this public delivery dental therapy model is for children, why won't they want it for adults too? And they actually fought to privatize this program in the mid-1980s, which is why we end up with this inferior dentist-centered fee-for-service model program for low-income children rather than all children. The program was completely dismantled. And it's something that we need to bring this dental therapy model back. The federal dental plan that's being proposed now is very much trying to not offend dentists, trying to not make them feel threatened in any way. But if we really want to get to the heart of the problem, we don't need to just increase public dental spending. We need to rapidly increase the public delivery of dental care. And it's a very urgent thing because we're also seeing the rise of dental corporations, which are these big financial entities that owned hundreds of dental practices that are turning dental clinics into these money-making machines. I think that the need for increased public funding of dental care is very urgent. I'm glad to see some movement at the federal level. I hope that we can actually create enough momentum to make it a reality and use that momentum to launch ourselves towards a universal system, but also look at increasing very rapidly the public delivery of dental care as well.
Now, we've talked about this kind of under the scope of being a health issue, but in a lot of ways, and you wrote about it quite a bit in your book about how oral health can also create social barriers in life. And so could you kind of talk a little bit about how oral health is also a social issue?
Absolutely. So, you touch on the fact that like our smile has such an impact on our self-esteem, how we interact with the world. Obviously, having missing front teeth or visible dental decay can affect our employability. This is a big problem for many issues, but basically, it's one of the reasons people get trapped in the cycle of poverty. You could imagine if you can't afford to access dental care and you have missing front teeth or visible decay, not being able to find employment leads to kind of further exacerbating that problem, falling down the cycle of poverty and not being able to get out of it. So I see ensuring access to dental care is a way of helping people live dignified quality of life and trying to help break the cycle of poverty as well. I think we could all imagine how difficult it is just being able to chew, if something as simple as that. How do you go out and eat with friends? It's so hard to interact socially, as well as how much dental pain can impact just being able to sleep. How can you focus at work? How can you interact with people in, a high quality way when you've been suffering from a dental pain, which if anyone's actually experienced this, you know how miserable that is. And it's hard for people to wrap their mind around, I think, too, because I think there's been some shift in this, but people tend to blame people more for, their oral health problems than they do, if someone has like a heart attack or something. There tends to be more acknowledgement of like their societal structures that lead to certain problems for those health problems. But it's the same thing for dental care as well. If you're stuck in the cycle of poverty, you're much more likely to eat unhealthy foods, not necessarily have the knowledge of, what causes cavities, how to prevent them, all of these other things that lead to people who can't access dental care to have more dental disease as well, which are all problems that kind of feed into each other and make the problem even worse. An analogy that I like to give in a case like this, there's actually two of them that I think help people relate to this issue. One of them is imagine if every cavity you've ever had in your life led to the tooth being extracted, because that's what it's like for someone who's poor and can't afford to get access to dental care. Because the longer you wait, the worse it gets until it just becomes, unbearable and you need the tooth taken out. It's no longer savable. So that's exactly what it's like for people who are unable to access dental care. Another story that I like to give that I think highlights kind of the social element of this is The last year I've worked mainly, I worked in private practice before this, but the last year I've worked mainly as a dentist in a federal prison. And seeing people who are, full grown adults come to me and say, "This is the first time I've been to a dentist in my life." Some, there's other people say, "This is the first time I've been to a dentist in my adult life." But that's a very regular thing for me to hear because people just haven't been able to afford to go to a dentist sooner. And I've had people come up to me and tell me, like, "I'm supposed to be released from prison soon, but I'm actually going to defer my release so I can get all my teeth taken out and get dentures made because I know if I don't get this done now, I'll never get it done in my life." And they know, like, I'm not going to be able to find a job. They know how difficult their life is going to be. So they actually choose to stay in prison longer, which it's so hard to wrap your mind around what their living conditions actually are to actually come to that conclusion. And I think having a level of empathy for these people and realizing that, very subtle differences in our own lives could lead us to being in their shoes. And actually having the humility to say, like, we do need to treat people with dignity and respect.
And just to finish this all out here, Brandon, I'm wondering, I always ask authors this when I interview them, what did writing this book teach you?
It taught me a lot of things. To be honest, writing's not necessarily the strongest point of mine. So it was great to be able to work on something that's kind of a shortcoming of mine, especially in a longer format. You really have to organize your thoughts. I think it helped me paint a picture more fully as far as access to dental care in Canada, because I've had all of the, I've read the studies, I've been over all of this information, but actually trying to organize it in a succinct way helps create that narrative in my own mind as far as what the problems are. Where do we need to aim our frustration with this system? How do we need to try to build momentum around these issues? And I think it's a very exciting time for this because I started this work, I believe it was 2019, and it already feels like we're starting to see some recognition that there is at least a problem at a federal level. But I think it's really important that we don't become complacent because things aren't actually in place yet. And even if it does, there's still a lot of work to be done. So when I started my book, when I started doing this advocacy work, so many people would tell me that these ideas of like a universal dental plan are too pie in the sky, they're too lofty. But what we see as feasible is subject to change. And really, what determines whether or not that happens or not is what people like you and I do about it. Do we get out there? Do we, raise our voices on this? Do we try to make a stink about it and say, "This is a problem, this is unacceptable"? Or do we just sit back and say, "It is the way it is"? And I obviously come out on the first part of that. And I want to use this book as a platform to help raise awareness for these issues and really try to build momentum around this.
Brandon Doucette, Dental Care in Canada. All right. Thanks very much, Brandon.
Thanks for having me.
Was Dr. Brandon Doucette, author of About Canada Dental Care, and Rabble National Politics reporter Stephen Wenzel in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Brandon and Stephen. You can get a copy of About Canada Dental Care at fernwoodpublishing.ca or order it at your favorite local bookstore. Now it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. This week in Canadian politics, parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg argues that while the current federal budget has talked about its commitments to First Nations, that commitment was not reflected in the latest federal budget. While there are some wins for Indigenous peoples in the 2023 federal budget, such as the $2 billion over 10 years for a new Indigenous health equity fund and $4 billion over 7 years for an Indigenous housing strategy, Nirenberg argues that this is not nearly enough. If the federal government was serious about recognizing self-determination for Indigenous peoples, Nirenberg writes, it would affirm their ownership and control over the land and natural resources on their traditional territories. This would include oil, gas, and other minerals below the Earth's surface. Read Nirenberg's full analysis of how the 2023 federal budget affects Indigenous peoples on rabble.ca today. In Labour news this week, Labour reporter Gabriella Kalugay-Kasuga reports the Public Service Alliance of Canada, or PSAC, is prepared to start one of Canada's largest strikes ever. After more than a year and a half at the bargaining table, PSAC, which represents over 120,000 federal public servants, has voted overwhelmingly in support of a strike mandate. The union is now in legal strike position, but has told reporters at a press conference on Wednesday, April 12th, that they will not be taking immediate action. Instead, they intend to finish negotiation sessions that have been scheduled for this week. Since talks began in June 2021, wages have been at the forefront of these long and fraught negotiations. Chris Aylward, national president of PSAC, told reporters that what happens next is in the government's hands. Aylward says it's not a goal of PSAC to go on strike, but to reach a tentative agreement. Also this week, when police forcibly remove the homeless population from the street, where do we expect them to go? In her column this week, Kathy Crow explains how evicting the homeless from encampments ignores the real solution of finding sustainable and affordable housing for all. Crow explains how cities across Canada are treating homeless people in encampments like an infestation, quote, attempting to control and stomp them out so they would never come back. That is violence, end quote. This week in world politics, national politics reporter Stephen Wenzel brings rabble readers inside the fight to save queer and trans lives in Ukraine. Munich Kiev Queer is an organization that has pivoted from raising awareness and holding demonstrations to protecting LGBTQIA+ individuals struggling to survive in the war-torn country of Ukraine. As Conrad Breyer of Munich Kiev Queer explains, the organization now has two missions. The first, to help queer and trans people in Ukraine who are in need of essentials like shelter, clothing, food, and prescription medication. The second, to help LGBTQIA+ Ukrainian refugees settle in communities across Germany. Finally, join us for Off the Hill this month. Foreign interference has made headlines in Canada lately, but what about corporate interference? Corporate interference, or corporate capture, refers to the means by which large corporations can and do influence politicians and political decision-making. We have to wonder, how does corporate interference affect the climate crisis in Canada? This month, join our Off the Hill political panel as we discuss this and more. Save your spot for this free event today and join us this April 19th, 2023 at 7:30 p.m. Eastern, 4:30 Pacific. As always, you can find the full versions of these stories and much, much more on rabble.ca. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nierenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.